It is 6 o'clock, and it is the first Thursday of the month, and that means it is time once again for the Post-Prison Education Program radio show, and we are joined live in the studios once again by the Post-Prison Education Program president and founder, Ari Cohn. Ari, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Bob.
Spending another another month in a different kind of lockdown than
prison lockdown.
Than the ones you're used to. So and this, we had this last month. That was when we did the show then.
Yeah, we just, can't, you know, started. I can't, people with have good sense won't leave their homes. And
you and I both don't have good sense.
Proves I don't have good sense. I mean, I've even been in prison in the last month.
Oh, wow.
And but we can't have guests on like we've had in the past. And I really wanted, like I said last time, I really wanted Hannah Myrick and Taylor Buck to come do a show without me here and talk about things that they're passionate about. But they're sheltering in place and hardcore about it. So they'll probably live through this and we won't. Whatever. So
time will tell.
Yeah.
So for those that are going to see, we shoot video, sometimes successfully,
yeah.
of each episode we do. and for those that are going to be watching the video, they're going to notice that you, have, some significant, additions to your fine facial features,
yeah,
that you didn't have last month.
You know, I could get on a rant about one bus away in King County Metro real easy. So we had, the nonprofit, we use Zipcar extensively. And especially if we're going to have a prisoner or former prisoner or somebody like that in the car. And we had we closed out the clothing room after 10 years within the last 30 days. And we met, Taylor and I met Cammie Carl from Goodwill there to get the last racks of clothing out. And so I had a zip car and I got it and I had to turn it in the next morning by sometime, I forget what. And so I took it to the Green Lake Park and Ride where we picked it up at. And then I had a WebEx scheduled for 10:30. And I was maybe 10-12 minute walk from my house. But I got out of the zip car, checked the One Bus Away app. It said the next 62 was 24 minutes away. So I start walking towards home. And I'm not expecting to hear a bus coming behind me on Woodlawn. And then I heard one. I turned around to confirm it was a bus. And it was the 62, completely off schedule. And so then I whirled around to start running to catch the bus. And you know how roots on trees, especially I think on Woodlawn, all the sidewalks are broken. And I immediately, so I'm in the first few steps of starting to run full blast, and I immediately tripped on a break in the sidewalk, and I went face first, I mean literally face first into the sidewalk. Two broken fingers, this is healing now, but stitches in my upper lip, blood everywhere, and the bus driver stopped, and she wouldn't let me on the bus because blood just everywhere, and I'm like madder than hops. She won't let me on the bus because I don't want to walk home like this. And so she got off the bus, gave me a bunch of paper towels, which was super nice. And then I got home, and anyway, so that's what happened. So it was like, and then by the next day, I was ended up at Kaiser Permanente in Capitol Hill for 6 hours. stitches inside my upper. I'm super lucky that my teeth didn't go. They went through my upper gum, but my lip. But my lip protected my teeth. I'm lucky they didn't break. Then I would have really been in a mess. So, anyway, that's that. And I look a lot better today than I did the other day when this happened. I got to tell you. So, anyway,
it was. Yeah, when you first arrived, I have heard many of your tales of. Working with different agencies, different people that aren't always cooperative, so I assumed the worst, actually, at first.
No, it was like, that's what happened. And it wasn't even a stupid old person thing. It was just like the bus off schedule, and I didn't want to miss the 10:30 WebEx or be late or whatever, and so I just whirled around and started to run, trip, bam. And it was bad. It's all right now. So anyway.
All right. Well, a lot has transpired since last month. And you had just been talking about that you had gotten rid of the clothing room, which is significant because you guys, I just got to see your new digs down in the Soto area a couple months back.
Yeah,
and I hadn't seen that before. I hadn't seen the clothing room. Yeah. It was a big deal. What was that for? And talk a little bit about that because that's a significant change.
You know, it was years ago. A lot. We were still in the central building downtown, and it was pretty cool. So Men's Warehouse chose us. We didn't apply. They somehow found out about us to be the recipient of donated clothes for King County, and in Pierce County they chose United Way, and And so what happens, you know, every year, this coming year will be the first year they haven't done it in a decade, but every year in July, they have a suit drive. And you can, you know, there was that King 5 did like a movie about it. It was a cool movie, news report movie, but it was, you could take your suit into any men's warehouse in the country and donate it, and then get a coupon or something so that you could buy new suits at half off, basically. And then once a week or so, trucks would come from their main warehouse. Like Men's Warehouse has a monstrous warehouse down in Fife, their central warehouse, just huge. And so the trucks would go around to the stores, pick up the donated suits, take them to their warehouse, and then 1 week United Way from Pierce County would come up and pick up as many suits as they wanted, and then the next week we would go. Eventually they opened it up. Anyway, that's how, so we ended up, we were in the central building, and Wachtel, Washington Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, moved out of the central building, and they had a room that was open that they used as a central file room for all their legal files, and it was quite large. And we got the building owner at the time to like let us have that rent free. So that was the clothing room for a long time, and then it was really cool. So like the federal defender's office, this is one example. So Mike Filipovich, who's an angel, is the federal defender, and his office, the women in his office got PO'd that Men's Warehouse was donating only men's stuff and that women's clothes weren't getting donated. So they called up again a long, long time ago. They called up and would we take women's clothes, and we're like, heck yeah. And so I remember one time we had to take Nicole Pauly Davenport and I, we had two cars, and we had to make multiple trips over to the Federal Defender's Office at Westlake. And we had the clothes, the women's clothes, back up above, so you couldn't see out the rear window, which is illegal. And we had to make multiple trips because the women there donated so much stuff. So it got to be women lawyers in town. We even had a judge, who a Superior Court judge, and she dresses very nice. And she would pull up at the back alley of the central building in her SUV, Mercedes, and donate her clothes. So and then, you know, until Dow Constantine and his, the clown that used to work with him, I've forgotten his name, I blocked it out, I guess. But that when they made this move to take the federal, I mean, the public defender firms, so Northwest Defender Association, the Defender Association, ACA, SCRAP, and pull them into King County government, until that happened, and when we were still downtown, those four nonprofit public defense firms would come down and get whole racks of clothes and take to their offices so that when people were going on trial, they could look nice, right? And then we had former prisoners who came out of the women's prisons who were taking clothes out to the women's prison. And so a lot of people came to rely on that room. But when we left the central building and moved to Soto, the only space that was open in that huge building that we're in for the clothing room was too big. I mean, so it was about $2,100 a month, and with taxes and shared cost of the building, it was like $2,800 a month, as opposed to our cost in the central building is like $550 a month. So all of a sudden you're looking at $30,000 a year instead of $6,000 a year. But when we made the move, it was rush, and I didn't want to throw away maybe $10,000-$15,000 worth of really nice clothes, so I wasn't going to just abandon the clothes. I would have been dumb as a dumb can be. And so we worked out a deal with the building manager where we're at to do a month-by-month lease. But then we were like, you know, the first thing that happened was we're like several miles south of downtown, and so we're far removed from the public defense firms, and they've been assimilated into Dow Constantine's government. They seemed to maybe have lost some of their focus, but we were remote. It wasn't as easy as TDA people coming from the 8th floor of the central building down to the mezzanine level and grabbing racks of clothes. And then I think COVID-19 has had a lot to do with it. So we got an email from Men's Warehouse maybe two months ago, but I had already decided to close the room, but they were ending the program. So, Taylor Buck, who works with me, we were out at the men's prison at Shelton and talking to this incredibly great guy that works for DOC and in their sustainability lab, which is an amazing operation. And I told him about, and it turned out that they tried to get suits in for the men there because a lot of people released from Shelton. And I said, we've got maybe 12, 15 racks of men's suits, and, you know, if you can come get them, you can have them. So DOC sent a big truck up from Shelton. I put it on Facebook. If you go to the program's Facebook page, you can see a picture of the truck driving away. But 254 suits, 12 racks. Those suits are at Shelton now. So guys can, instead of releasing with just the khakis that you're wearing, a really flimsy white t-shirt, and you can release with some nice clothes. We had a lot of women's clothes that we obviously couldn't send to the men's prison in Shelton. And so we contacted Cammy at Goodwill, who we've partnered with for a long time, and I've been friends with her since forever, and asked her if Goodwill would be interested. So they came down a week or 10 days ago with a truck, and we loaded all the adult women's clothes up to go to Goodwill. And then we moved the baby's clothes, which were donated by Google employees at Kirkland, Google Kirkland, about 30 bags of incredibly nice baby's clothes. We moved those upstairs, and we've got to get those, you know, to our main office. We've got to get those down to the baby program at Purdy. But that's, with COVID-19, it's, you know, that's on hold till whenever this happens. So that was kind of, that was a sad thing to see come to an end, and it'll hurt a lot of people, but we can't spend $30,000 a year on a clothing room. And the other thing is, I got into an argument with a board member of ours that over this. She was like brain dead and hadn't really thought this through, but it saved us a lot of money. So if somebody comes out and we didn't have the clothing room, we might send them to Ross and they might spend $1,200-$1,400 buying clothes, right? But the way we work when we had the clothing room is they would go down to the clothing room and get as much from there as they could that fit them. And then we would send them to Goodwill for clothing and other support. And then maybe we would only have to spend $171 or $400 at Ross or Fred Meyer in Bellingham or whatever, as opposed to what normally, you know, outfitting somebody $1,200, $1,400. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money. If you're going to dress decent to look decent in school so you're not going to be embarrassed, or you're going to be able to go apply for a job, do both things, school and job, to get completely outfitted minimally, you know, $1,200 isn't a lot of money. It's in winter when you got a winter coat in the mix and so on. So it was a cost-saving vehicle for us. So from the $3,000 a month we would have spent for the A28 warehouse space of about 1,100 square feet, those costs were offset by not having to buy clothes at Ross or as many clothes at Ross or Fred Meyer as otherwise. So it was kind of sad. And, you know, King Five did a fabulous. They did like a news report that turned out to be a movie about it. And they actually watched. They went down to the prison at Coyote Ridge and filmed a prisoner releasing because they wanted to see him get the men's warehouse suit that they'd seen donated, right? And they followed us. It was so weird. They followed us all the way. We always stop at Perkins Pancake House in Ellensburg. You've been with us before, right?
Yeah.
And they followed us all the way from the prison in Connell up to I-90. We're stopping at Perkins Pancake, and we got these camera crews, just like 11 or 12 of us, and they're like all around our table, and people in the restaurant are like, who are these people? And we actually had one couple walk over like, who are you? What's all this about? But then they followed us from Blueberry Pancakes up to the office, and then Keith going into the clothing room and getting the suit that they had filmed be donated. And then the end of the week, they filmed us at Pierce College in Fort Steilacoom, where he's walking into school wearing the suit that was donated.
Oh, that's great.
So it was like pretty
cool. That was with Keith, who was later employed.
Yeah, yeah.
With you.
Yeah.
And now is doing great down in Olympia.
Yeah. He's working for Catholic Community Services. It goes so against the grain of what the public thinks about prisoners and former prisoners. This guy works for Catholic Community Services in a program that partners with the Olympia Police Department. And in fact, when I coming out of Shelton the other day, I wanted Taylor to meet Keith, and they hadn't met, and so I called and had him meet us at Wagner's, and so his boss from the Olympia Police Department came, and so here I'm sitting with Keith, who has like 40 felony convictions. On the negative side, on the positive side, a four-year degree from Evergreen State College in Olympia, and six imprisonments, and he's working a great job, partnered with the police department, and he's high value, you know. So it was like, so we're sitting there eating key lime pie and cherry pie, and police and former prisoners, and Taylor with her master's degree in gender studies from Europe, and it was good. So it was good. So while we're talking about ignorance, let's talk about this reporter in the Tacoma News Tribune. What's his name? James Drew. D-R-E-W. So when Inslee, and it's sad, by the way, to see the News Tribune, which was really an ally of ours back in 2006 and 7, when they had completely different editorial people, a completely different political slant, different reporters. A guy who I worshipped and remember fondly, Joe Turner, who's died since, his wife's still alive, but the News Tribune's evolved into something just ignorant and deplorable since those days. So and that ignorance came out in an article written by this guy James Drew on April 23rd. The article is entitled "State, Inmates, Attorney Clash Over COVID-19 Early Release Plan," and it was right after Inslee announced the early releases of 1,100 prisoners. And Columbia Legal Services filed a writ of mandamus with the Supreme Court to try to force the DOC to release enough prisoners so that the remaining people who were locked up could social distance and not die, right? So in that environment, this idiot, James Drew, a reporter for the News, wrote this horrible article, and he was talking about, he had a set in his mind. Clearly, he had in his mind who these prisoners would be that were going to be released under order from Inslee, and. You know, aside from the fact that Inslee, for political reasons, has ordered the wrong people to be released and excluded people who should be released, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I got to say, I don't know how I admire Inslee. I think he's doing a great job with what he's doing with coronavirus, COVID-19. He and the governor of California, the governor of New York, are just exemplary in the whole nation. So I don't know how somebody could be that competent on one issue, and on another issue, prisoners, be such an absolute ignoramus. I mean, and be so governed by politics that he doesn't care if people die, and that's what's going to happen. So anyway, this guy, this reporter, I need to introduce this. So for people who were around in 2008 in Seattle, Skagit County, you should remember that a very seriously mentally ill young man basically rode up and down I-5 one afternoon shooting people to death. And his name was Isaac Zamora, Z-A-M-O-R-A. And everybody was terrified and horrified. including me, you know. And the story initially vilified him, and then it fell over on his family. So the community where his family lived turned against, like, his mom, which was horrible and wrong, at a very deep level, horribly wrong. But Zamora was so mentally ill. I mean, today he's in the special offender unit, which is one of the highest security prisons in the state, and it's one that's specifically for people suffering mental illness. And based on some recent quotes I've seen in the press, he's still psychotic. But in a psychotic episode, you can measure, there's levels of seriousness with mental illness, just like with everything, I guess. And he's way up there. I mean, I haven't looked to see whether DOC has him as S code 5 or what, but he's seriously mentally ill and psychotic and not in touch with reality when this happens. And he killed a deputy sheriff that he was friends with, who had befriended him and his family. And then he killed people that he didn't even know. So and all I can say is for people who might not understand what serious mental illness is about, like, go to Mayo Clinic and on their search line put in schizoaffective disorder and print out the 9 or 10 pages and sit down and read it. I mean, so that diagnosis is schizophrenia plus bipolar. So either of those things on their own are bad enough, but to have one person have a disease that's both of those wrapped into one diagnosis is unimaginable. But there's a significant number of people in the general population and in Washington DOC's prisons with that diagnosis, and with schizophrenia, and that are bipolar, and borderline personality disorder, and so he was just not in touch with reality, and a number of people died. Well, one of the people who died was a woman, and her husband was shot twice but lived. And so when Inslee announced that he was going to release these 1,100 prisoners, then the daughter of the woman who died and her dad, who had been shot twice, are down on the steps of the Capitol and, you know, on the legislative campus in Olympia protesting. And, I mean, I listened to the daughter. She did a Facebook thing, where Facebook Live, whatever it's called, and I sort of stumbled onto her page there was a post that I didn't agree with. It was almost like somebody trolling somebody else. So there was a post I did agree with, probably with a Facebook friend of mine, but then in the middle of posts that were intelligent, here was this idiot with a post. And so I clicked on his name, right? And then that took me to his page. And then I saw that this other name and with a link, right? And I clicked on the link, and it turned out to be the daughter of the mom who was killed. And she's sitting on the back porch of her house, and it was heartbreaking. As much as I disagree with what the News Tribune wrote and what she was saying and her lack of understanding about mental illness and the way they think of and classify Isaac Zamora and people like him, it was hard to listen to her. She was sobbing and in tears, and it was heartbreaking. And that happened in 2008, if I remember right. So that's 12 years ago, and she's still heartbroken, right? So anyway, this James Drew
Tacoma News Tribune.
With the News Tribune, yeah. I'm like, Oh, well, I just got an email from the president of yours. Never mind. Oh, it's a text. Holy mackerel. Anyway, they connected, right? And so he made her be the basis for this article that he put out that I referred to a minute ago. And when he wrote about Isaac Zamora, there was no background. So people who weren't around in 2000, I mean, with me, the minute I read Zamora, I knew who he was. I have talked to his mom. Back in those days, I talked to his mom. What the community she lived in did to her was outrageous. And frankly, what Chris Gregoire, who was governor at the time, did and how she reacted was just dumb effing stupid and outrageous and unforgivable and reprehensible. So it's like, but when I saw Zamora's name in this James Drew article, with no background, they're just talking about Inslee's. He wrote the article as though Inslee had, or everybody that was going to be released on Inslee's order was like Zamora. And he didn't say, he might not have even bothered to be responsible enough to check out the story behind Zamora, right? But he, I mean, the whole thing back then was so bad. I had Gregoire's personal email because I was a big donor. When I was stupid enough to donate to the Democratic Party, I was a big donor, one of the top 30 donors in the state, actually. And so when Howard Dean came to town, I was one of the ones in the cocktail party on the top of Smith Tower, right? And I wrote Gregoire and Cindy Zender, our chief of staff, and said, I want my money back because of the way she reacted to this. So, but what happened was he didn't research Zamora at all. He didn't put any context. There was no discussion of mental illness. It was just like this vile guy who has recently said, if I get released, I'll finish what I started. And that's psychotic mental illness speaking, right? I don't doubt that he said that. He probably did say that. But he's super seriously mentally ill, not in touch with reality. And that could happen. Frankly, I wish it would happen to James Drew, right? I do. I really do. And his editors. So maybe they could, somebody in that crew could come away with a better understanding of mental illness. But anyhow, no framing. It was just this horrible guy, murdered all these people, shot this young woman's mom to death, killed the deputy sheriff, blah, 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 and just didn't frame the issue at all, and left readers to believe, you know, in a major newspaper that's very well read, left readers to believe that everybody that was going to be released on Inslee's order was like Zamora, and might possibly, I guess, ride up and down I-5 and shoot seven people to death or something, right? I don't know how to even express it. And Taylor Buck in my office went nuts, and she wrote the News Tribune. I mean, I think she asked me for permission, but if I had said no, I think she was gonna do it anyway, and then she wrote James Drew an email and copied half the Seattle Times and other people, and then when I saw it, and it's on our Facebook page, we posted it,
and your website.
And we put it on the website, I had Hannah put it out on our listserv, Taylor's email, but provided the background and tried to put the thing in context. So we should switch over, and talk about who Inslee is having released and why, and who should be released. And really, you know, I was thinking on the way over here, just by way of introduction, the legislature had this huge reentry task force. It was legislated in 2005, and came into force in the beginning of 2006, and it ran for 9 months. And at the end of the 9 months, right before Thanksgiving, the report went from the task force to Gregoire, and the objective was to find ways to reduce recidivism. So there were four work groups, and I was on three of the four work groups. And a lot of the meetings were in Senate Hearing Room 1. And we had Senate, we had legislative staff, I mean, attorneys, we had major resources available. And members of the legislature were involved, stakeholders, nonprofits, law enforcement, WASPIC, everybody. It was well balanced. And we got down to a hearing one day, because one of the top recommendations of that task force was education, post-secondary education. And we ended up in a hearing during the 2007 legislative session where bills that came out of that task force were being considered. It was Senate Bill 5070 and Mary Helen Roberts' House Bill 1874 were being considered. And I was testifying in hearing in front of James Hargrove, who was chair, he's retired now, he was chair of the Human Services Committee in the Senate at the time. And we presented a lot of data, and at the end, Hargrove said verbatim, you know, he basically thought of post-secondary education as being a promising practice, when there was rock-solid data that it was way more than that, right? And I almost said out loud, but I kept it to myself. It's all these years later, and I remember, I was like, where is Harry Truman when you need him? And that's, you know, because whether you agree with what he did with the atomic bomb or firing MacArthur or any of the things he didn't make decisions based on yesterday's polls. You know, he didn't make decisions. He was like, I don't care if I get reelected. I don't care. I'm going to do what I believe is right. That doesn't exist anymore. And Inslee and all these, here I am like, can't use my first language, which is profanity. All these pieces of fill in the blank who are members of the Washington State Legislature. So there's not one person down there who has enough courage to do anything right. And if they try to do something right, then like the Democratic caucus will squash it, especially when Chop was, you know, Speaker of the House. But I just was like, I literally was thinking, where is Harry Truman when you need him? Listening to Hargrove that day. And so that kind of legislative cowardice is what's governing Inslee's decisions. And so maybe David Postman is saying, if you let out people who've committed violent crimes, you'll never get reelected for your third term, right? Or some other person is saying that to him, or he just believes that. But what they've decided to do is release people with nonviolent crimes. And if you were watching the news last week, you can see the result of it already. It's like, I think it was Como. So some guy comes, is part of this early release, and on his first day out, new crime, high-speed chase, and he's back in some jail somewhere headed back for prison, right? What most of the people with nonviolent crimes are, that's like property crimes, and they're, for the most part, stealing your electronics. This is a gross oversimplification, but you know, so they're not committing murder, they're not assaulting or brutalizing somebody, it's not rape, they're property crimes. And property crimes are to get money to buy drugs to feed addiction. That's a fair generalization. So if you're going to release people that are nonviolent, so the public won't get all fired up and you won't have idiots like James Drew from the News Tribune, the IDIOTS idiots like James Drew and his staff and his people that he reports to, raising hell, then, you can say, well, we're only going to release nonviolent crimes, right? People with nonviolent crimes. They're doing that for political reasons because they're considering what the backlash would be if they let loose somebody who had committed a serious crime. And the fact of the matter is, for example, people who commit first-degree murder have the lowest rate of recidivism of all classes of crimes, bar none, period. So if you took a guy, Don Wilchius, who's been on this show before, and I have a close friend who I'm not going to name, but she did over 30 years in prison against a life sentence before she got out, and she's just living a spectacular life right now. So if she was still locked up, and she's been out for quite a while now, and just is a model citizen doing beautifully well, if she was locked up now, she wouldn't be considered for early release, but she would have been the best candidate. Or we're working really closely with a guy, I don't know whether I should name him or not, but I'm going to, Billy Joe Rutledge. So he's in one of the five prisons at Monroe. He's finishing 17 years, violent crimes. I'm going to have him at the University of Washington, winter quarter 2021. If I haven't died of a heart attack or been shot or something, he'll be at the University of Washington winter quarter 2021. And he might not do as well as Jenny Burton, who just won the Truman Scholarship, but he'll do really well. Those are the kind of people that should be released, but they're not. And they won't come out and commit new crimes the first day after they release. Inslee has framed this, so we're only going to let nonviolent people out. And that's just really, truly, I don't even have the words to describe how dumb that is. And it's going to backfire. I got into I got into a pissing match in an email with Roger Goodman about a month ago. Inslee's general counsel, Catherine Leathers, was on the email. Sonia Hallam, Inslee's advisor, was on the email. And what I told Roger was like, this was in reference to the MAT program and Inslee having ordered the prisons to be flooded with Suboxone. Just dadgum near, everybody in the prison's in active addiction. So when they release, they're in active addiction, right? And then they've got to get, they don't have any money, they don't have a job, so they've got to go get money to buy drugs to feed their addiction, right? That's how that plays out. And so I told Goodman, I mean, you're going to see this in increased recidivism rates. A year from now or so, data is going to prove you to be the idiot you are, the coward you are. And Jeannie Darnielle, every damn one of them. I mean, really. That applies to this. Recidivism is nonstop climbed since that reentry task force in 2006 that was held for 9 months to figure out how to reduce recidivism. It was about 28% then, and now it's just at about 34%. And what's happening now by choosing to release nonviolent people with nonviolent records to appease an ignorant public that really is ignorant because Blethyn Incorporated and the News Tribune and the Walla Walla Union Bulletin and so on won't write the truth about who prisoners are. And so the public's left to be ignorant, right? He's appeasing the voting public by saying, we're only letting out these powder puff nonviolent people, right? And he should be letting out people, I mean, some people in that category who have conquered addiction and managed it and will do well, But they should also be looking at people with, who have violent crimes that were committed 20, 30 years ago, often, you know, and they've programmed like crazy. They've gotten degrees in college. They've gone through HVAC programs. They're clean and sober. Their future envisioning what they did 20, 30, 40 years ago was a one-time thing. It's not going to happen again. And it's they're the ones that are safe to release. But then you're releasing people with violent crime records, and which really has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with who they are today or is what's a wise decision. You know, should we release this person or this person? And so it's just legislative cowardice. Inslee wants to be reelected. And maybe he'll be gone by the time the data reflects how bad this decision is. But it's really bad. I mean, I was talking to somebody who's fairly high up at DOC headquarters this morning about the situation out in Spokane, and it's an early release, right? And this exact thing, and she acknowledged what I'm saying. I mean, so people at DOC know this is a stupid move, but Inslee's ordered it. Steve Sinclair reports to the governor, right? If he wants to keep working, then he better do what the governor says. So the governor wants nonviolent people with nonviolent records released, so that's who's going to get released. And, I mean, the guy that I was in this email tiff with and then ended up on the phone with DOC about, we interviewed him in a WebEx from the prison at Airway Heights the other day, and multiple incarcerations, a lifetime of addiction, a lifetime of going back to prison, mental illness, S-code 2. The DOC has him high risk to recidivate, but he's a nonviolent. He has a nonviolent crime, right? So he's been to prison. Some people I've worked with would call him a recidivating machine, right? So he's just like come out, you know, release, go back, you know, 4, 5, 6 times. And ESCO 2, which is a DOC classification for serious mental illness, stable but mentally ill. And the DOC has him as high risk to recidivate. But because his crimes are basically, I mean, they're all drugs and addiction related. They fit the nonviolent classification that Inslee's ordered, and that's who's he's gonna release, right? And we're gonna support him, and we'll have him at Spokane Community College very quickly. But you know, right now in the old days, we would jump in a zip car, and within 24 hours of his release, we would meet him in Spokane. We would walk the campus, introduce him to advising, get him enrolled, take him to Olive Garden for his first meal out, take him to JCPenney's for some clothes, put a cell phone in his hand, put a Chromebook in his hand, get him a gift card to a grocery store, Winco or whatever's near where he's living. That's all impossible now. So he'll come out into a world that he couldn't comprehend. I mean, I'm living in this world. You're living in this world. You can't, it's surreal. I live in a really nice house in a beautiful neighborhood overlooking Green Lake. And it's just surreal. I've got this daily routine trying to maintain sanity or find sanity. I take this morning walk every day. It's about a 2.5 mile walk. I walk from my house up to Tangletown and to Mighty O Donuts. I get an apple fritter and English breakfast hot tea, and I walk back. I mean, and yesterday, not one moving car, that's unbelievable. And I didn't pass anybody on any sidewalk. And that's unbelievable. In the Green Lake area, that's unbelievable. And so it's just, I saw one crow. Usually there's herds of crows following me around wanting donuts and bread and all that, like they're my best friends, right? And one crow. So he's going to come out into this world where everything's closed, can't get a job, the schools are closed, you can't get in touch with anybody. And, you know, we'll see. And, you know, it's like, we're down to 9 minutes, but, you know, we had, I think every time I'm on the show, I say something along these lines, but I've got so many friends and allies that just disparage the DOC to the point you'd think that there's nothing right about the Department of Corrections, and that's just wrong. And so they're out at the prison at Forks. There's a counselor who's spectacularly supportive of prisoners, but he's not the only one. But he has advocated for months about for this guy who, again, is a recidivating machine, Native American guy, and he just, this guy from DOC basically sort of badgered us into like interviewing this guy, and just because we like this counselor and respect him and we worked with him before, we decided to do it, right? And so we had a WebEx and interview with him, five of us on the interview, and we went into the interview thinking we weren't going to like meeting him, and that he was going to be like a mentally ill basket case that we couldn't work with, and we all fell in love with him. I mean, really, we fell in love with him, and we wanted to work with him, and we made a commitment, right? He released, and he sounded really great. He released to Transition House here in town from the prison out at Forks, and he didn't make it one day. We weren't able to make contact with him, and so we contacted the lady who runs the house, Lisa Hall, and she told Taylor that on his first day he said he was going to the store and he never came back. So there's warrants out for him, right? But that's what's going to happen. You have 1,100 people, many of whom are going to instantly, you know, commit. They're going to commit new crimes, trying to not go hungry, trying to not be homeless on the streets, trying to figure out COVID-19 environment we're all living in. It's the summary, bottom line is Inslee's picked the wrong people for political reasons. And frankly, somebody ought to lock his ass up down in Walla Walla and throw away the key. And then find somebody responsible to put in the governor's office, because he's not it. It's really, I mean, and communities are going to pay the price. So that's it.
And that's going to seriously impact any potential other future releases like that, when you assume they're all going to point back to that one, saying, oh, well, look what happened when Inslee released those 1,100 people back in 2020.
Exactly. And nobody will differentiate. Nobody will differentiate. It's not like, I think the general public seems to think of prisoners as one lot of people that are all bad or something, you know. And they don't say, well, these people are mentally ill, these people suffer trauma. You know, I watched the Centoya Brown documentary that's on Netflix now, and it's very good. She's come out against it because Netflix, for some insane reason, didn't reach out to her. So her life story, in essence, is in this really good documentary with actual footage of when she was arrested, you know, when she was tried, when she was locked up as a 15-year-old kid. when she was sentenced to prison. All of that, there's real footage of the courtroom proceedings, of the arrests, of her in jail, interviews with her biological mom or adoptive mom. So her, she had, and I put it on my Facebook. You may have seen it. It was like, everybody needs to watch this. It's like, so she has developmental issues, and it comes from being inside a mom that during her whole pregnancy was boozing. And so that's called fetal alcohol syndrome. And so she, I don't know if brain damage is the right word, but she has some developmental issues. She knows she has them. The court knew she had them. So you've got, in Locked Up, you've got people with fetal alcohol syndrome. That's not their fault that their mom was a goddamn alcoholic boozing during pregnancy. You've got traumatic brain injury, which is really equally heartbreaking or more. I mean, that can be, you know, some mother's boyfriend throws the baby against the wall. There's people in prison. When Scott Frakes was at DOC, he's now head of DOC in Nebraska, but when he was here, I saw a grant that the DOC wrote trying to get funding to just help deal with people who are locked up, who pretty much can't succeed on the outside due to fetal alcohol syndrome and TBI, traumatic brain injury. So you've got people in that group. They're hated. They're not, the public doesn't say, you know, differentiate between them and other prisoners. You've got people who were traumatized by sexual assault and abuse is children that are permanently damaged. And then you've got people with mental illness. And then you've got adults who are mentally healthy and maybe not addicted who've committed violent crimes. But it's just all across the board, and the public doesn't differentiate. They just think of them as one lot. And what needs to be happening right now is people need to be making wise decisions. And they're not. You know, when Catherine Leathers became Inslee's general counsel, I was hopeful because I dealt with her. She did a lot of work on a bill that I cared a lot about for Roger Goodman. And she was super helpful. So when Nick Brown left Inslee's office and Catherine came over, I was hopeful, but I shouldn't have been. You know, so she got over, in essence, to the governor's mansion and ate the cookies with the funny stuff in them, you know, who knows what. And Sonia Hallam came over from DSHS and ate the cookies with the funny stuff in it, and they're just all making really bad decisions. And we're going to pay out here, you know. The public, the community is going to pay because wise decisions aren't being made. I mean, really, they should be like looking. The guy we interviewed in the WebEx, his release date, ERD, was November 20th. And last week, or this week, Taylor got a call from the prison saying that he's been added to the list for early release and he'll be released within a week. So all of the government's planning for his release hasn't even started. The navigator, her name's Maria Daniels, and she was the basis for my argument this morning with DOC. So she's the navigator. She works for the state board through Spokane Community Colleges. She hasn't even been in touch with this guy. So like government's doing, Spokane Community Colleges has done nothing for this guy. And the navigator that the state has that's supposed to be helping prisoners navigate into community, she's done zip zero nada, other than be non-responsive, and so now the guy on short notice is going to be released, and we're trying to play catch up, and that's the end of the story.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so hopefully we can get the update on that particular story next month.
I hope to God Taylor and Hannah can get break out of their houses, but I probably not.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, regardless, looking forward to either seeing you or hearing from you this time next month.